From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we go to Philadelphia to sit with Professor Tony Montero, and we're going to discuss the, I guess we'll update the history of the contradiction we've been looking at since the run-up to the 2016 election in the political system here. The crisis, I guess, is a more accurate term than it's an amplification of the term contradiction. I guess they both apply. And there's an awful lot of stuff that's really up in the air and in motion and clashing, and a whole lot of people following this trend or that trend that are clashing too. And we might see that intensify as we go forward. In fact, it looks like it, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And you know, Don, and we're searching for the appropriate language to describe and explain what we've been looking at now going on 6 years or more. And we have been looking at this, you and I and others, with a great deal of intensity, because the future of this nation, as well as the future of this ruling class's ability to wage war, to shape the economic landscape on a global scale, all of that is at stake in the battle for power and the contradictions within, well, we could say, the ruling elite, and I want to talk about that, but the deepest contradiction is between the ruling class and the people. We see it in full bloom, and there's no way that any person who claims to be of the left can either be indifferent to this or act like I don't have a stake in this battle, because as it appears at this point, the sharpest edge of the political contradiction is between the white masses, in particular the white working class and impoverished people, and the ruling elites. That's the appearance of it, but at its essence, it is a class divide deeper than perhaps anything we have seen in this country, at least at the level of class.
You know, there's a really interesting thing that occurs to me while you're describing that. I mean, it's so complex, and it's something that's, you know, been evolving for such a long time. This white working class that is now in opposition, or in any event, a contradiction to power. Power is, you know, aimed at them in terms of, you know, the propaganda that they're deplorable and irredeemable, hopelessly racist and supremacist and such. Mm-hmm. That was the backbone of this elite, you know, like 10 minutes ago. And when they started saying, hey, what happened to the payoff we were getting before? They had good jobs, they got FHA loans, the kids were able to go to college, and all of this started to evaporate. They noticed which side of the line they were on and started speaking up about it. Suddenly, the elite is demonizing them and making nice with the people that they had previously been oppressing. In other words, it's like a role reversal on who's going to be the underclass now with the same elite in power.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we're looking at, to be real about it, a 40-year process of neoliberal austerity. A 40-year process has ruined much of the working class.
Right. By the way, let me interrupt here, just to be clear on what I was saying. We're talking about a role reversal in symbology more than anything. The black working class has become more pauperized over the last 10 years than at any period subsequent to maybe either the Depression or even Reconstruction in terms of the loss of wealth, you know, home ownership and such. Everybody is getting screwed. That is, I'm talking about who, in terms of propaganda and culture, which is very relevant, that there's been now, you know, suddenly the elite is the protector of the rights of the oppressed minority groups across the board, and the real oppressor is the white working class. That's the symbology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a fake narrative. It's a narrative invented by the ruling class to veil its role in this crisis. In fact, its role in hollowing out the state through its austerity and war policies, and to veil the fact that the ruling class has failed the people, it is incapable of governing the country, cannot rule in the old way, and the masses of people, irrespective of race, but especially if they are working people or part of the impoverished working class, are feeling the brunt of the policies of a ruling class. This is not, you know, let me put it this way. This is why this left fascination with settler colonialism and 1619 Project and even what they define as critical race theory or this new teaching of history, this is all about shielding the ruling class from the wrath of the working people.
Right.
And to make less defined the boundaries of class that is the key boundary, the key and intense engine driving this political crisis.
That's right. I mean, it's the same game that, you know, we saw the Nazis and the fascists play in the 20s and 30s, which is, the name of it is misdirection. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a crisis that's affecting everyone in very intensive and material ways. The cause of it is really obvious if you can actually look at it, but it's masked by all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no question about it. And, you know, because the ruling class commands the commanding heights of information and news and entertainment and what they call culture, they have the power to shape a narrative. Hollywood and cable news and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and all of that, they have the power to shape a narrative. So ideologically, they have a temporary advantage. But, you know, there's something about this uprising. For example, a recent poll says that only 52% of Americans trust elections.
Right.
I mean, that's huge in a country that claims to be a democracy. But 52%, and I would suggest if you go to discrete populations, like working people, like the black working class, you will find that fewer than that support elections, which is a judgment upon the right of the ruling elite to rule. People are saying they do not have legitimacy.
Right.
That they have not governed in the interest of the nation or of the people. This is huge. This is a turning point. This is what the spokespeople and intellectuals of the ruling class call a constitutional crisis, a crisis of democracy, or they'll sometimes say the center has collapsed. The center will not hold. And thus, the nation is breaking off into two extremes, the people versus the ruling elite.
And one of the problems that we're seeing is that among the people, they've divided into two teams, basically red and blue or whatever. And you see that divide in almost every public discussion. And of course, it's presented and massaged, and you know, it is part of the official narrative. And that official narrative, by the way, is much larger and all encompassing than any, you know, elite has had the opportunity to do in history.
Right.
When you went to work, even, you know, the long days, you had more time doing this, but even for 8 hours a day, next to, you know, one, two, three, a dozen other people, there was the water cooler conversation and the general culture where you exchanged ideas and perspective with other human beings face to face. All of that conversation now is mediated. I say something to you that I might have whispered at the water cooler, and it gets tagged with an italicized I and some statement interjected by someone from the Atlantic Council. And that's 50 to 75% of the time that I'm communicating with other people, whereas before, maybe on the telephone and watching TV took up an hour or two a day, and the rest was all person to person. So they have, in terms of narrative control, just in terms of absolute minutes that they're the only one talking, it's most of the day now.
Yeah. And you know, that goes along with the fact that institutions of society, such as unions, and the union hall where people could meet and talk out issues, or the churches,
right,
where people met, separate from and away from a ruling class narrative, or other institutions of what we call civil society,
right,
which are weaker than they were, let us say, 50 years ago. So it does allow the ruling class an advantage to mediate what people think, what they see, what are the representations and the symbols that they connect with. That is only temporary, I would say. This polling data says something very deep, that in spite of all of the ideological and propaganda advantages of the ruling class, the majority of the people still see this government, the government of the United States, as not serving their interests, and are very deeply dissatisfied, and I would argue on the cusp of rebelling and uprising again and rising up against this.
You know, there's a famous quote from John F. Kennedy, those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable.
Yeah.
We've seen attempts to express this, you know, frustration with the system come and go. First, they try to suppress it, and then they let it blossom, and then, you know, divert it into electoral politics, or in the case of like Occupy, what they did last time was to just shut it down with massive nationwide police action. The way that they've handled Black Lives Matter, you know, those uprisings against police murders, you know, became basically opportunities to co-opt people that were involved and bring them into the political system, and et cetera, et cetera. It seems to have a resilience for this, but there's a problem with that. It's the same problem that when you have someone that walks up to you smiling, shaking your hand and offering you a beer or whatever, everything is fine until they deliver that, what self-defense people call that castrati kick, and then punch you in the nose. No matter what else they said after that, you understand exactly what's going on. And I think people materially are in that position at this point in time where, you know, the nicety is a hard sell while their kids are hungry and, you know, facing eviction and all the other material problems that we're facing now, and a complete lack of solutions being presented.
Oh, yeah. And of course, you know, the people are not as dumb as the elites assume they are.
Right.
You know, people get fed up after a point with all of these professors and political strategists that are people are tired of being talked down to by so-called elites and experts. They're tired of it. And so a lot of them have turned to these various talk shows on the internet or other places. It's a hard thing to fully describe, except to say that we are in something that looks like a rebellion.
I'm watching this happen right now. Go ahead. Go ahead.
One last thing. I mean, you look at Joe Biden's poll numbers. I mean, they went from close to 60% in April, and now they're down to 37% approval rating. The majority of the people disapprove of the way he's running the government. When he got, the largest number of votes ever gotten by anybody running for president of the United States. And he was supposed to, be instituting these bold policies, and trillions of dollars would be spent in infrastructure and social infrastructure and so on. Well, look at where we are. More COVID infections in 2021 than in all of 2020. I mean, we're in a crisis, man.
Yeah.
And how it will end, it's hard to say, but we have to acknowledge it. And the other thing, Don, the crisis is also of the left. What do they now say after they spent so much political capital touting Joe Biden and the need to defeat Trump? I mean, unequivocal need to defeat Trump, because he was a fascist and the Democrats would institute a progressive agenda. Well, none of that has happened.
Just to add, insult to injury, basically, we're watching now them haggle over $2 or $3 trillion to be spent to supposedly remedy the situation, and hearing from them the largest problem facing the country is global warming. Not I'm getting evicted, not my son owes $80,000 for an education, they can't get him a job at Burger King, not my grandchildren have no future, not my Social Security is on the table again, but global warming or climate change or whatever they call it this week. But that trillions of dollars is going to be spent on something, not me.
Yeah. And they say, just part of their problem is they said the number, but they didn't say what it was for.
Exactly. I just said it was not for. It's not for us. People are going to look and see, how much do I get? How much do I get? None. Oh, great. How much did you spend? $3 trillion. Really?
Yeah, right. I mean, it's, and look, hey, Don, we follow this pretty carefully.
Right.
And we don't know what they're talking
right.
about.
I know. Well, they don't know what they're talking about. That's part
well,
of the problem, too.
So,
one of the I'm gonna hold on one sec. One example. Okay, they don't know what they're doing. I'm looking at the news. Actually, I was listening in the radio in the car yesterday, and there's an announcement, big announcement across NPR and CBS News Radio and all the rest. Like it's a big deal. Biden announces he's going to pay a bunch of money into ASEAN. The group of Southeastern Asian nations. Mm-hmm. How much? $100 million. This is supposed to help the U.S. compete with China. Now, there's 661 million people in the 10 countries that make up ASEAN, not including the United States. And $100 million into that is somewhere around 15 cents per head for places like Brunei, Vietnam. You know, they inflicted about, I don't know, $10 billion, $100 billion with the damage on Vietnam. They're going to pay everybody 15 cents.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's Biden's building back better.
Yeah, right.
In Asia, you know. Meanwhile, Cuba has signed up to the Chinese-sponsored Belt and Road Initiative.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And
they
I'm
don't get it.
Venezuela will not be far behind, and who knows right. who's next? Maybe Mexico.
Right. Yeah.
So we are looking at. Multiple crises, domestic political crises of rule. Can the ruling class rule? And in the international sphere, can the United States once again be the, quote, indispensable nation, end quote? Or can it once again be the, quote, leading democracy, end quote.
Well, 0 for 2 on that one. 0 for 2.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at a certain point, the ruling class looks so ridiculous, so inept, and frankly, so corrupt right. that that it's a joke. It's a joke, man. And how long can this bad joke continue? We don't actually know, but not long, I don't think.
You know, there's a word that keeps rolling into my head before that was bedeviling people, you know, 5 years ago. Unfortunately, they were fixated on it, but they were looking at the wrong phenomenon and ascribing the wrong words to it. I'm thinking now Weimar. You know, this is looking an awful lot like, you know, 1928 Germany or something, and then, you know, rolling out von Hindenburg in 1932 to deal with the crisis, and just the haplessness of the German state at that point in time that made even a clown, because Hitler was really a clown.
Yeah.
But the
yeah.
conditions were like Biden or worse. God knows what's in, you know, they've got up their sleeve next that we're going to get. It may actually be, you know, they might roll out Bozo or somebody. God knows. They had Bonzo already. Think of all the ink they could save on those ends. But seriously, I mean, it's looking like not only is this crisis, you know, growing and intensifying and affecting the real thing. Forget all the theoretical nonsense about it. The lives of the people are becoming more and more immiserated, and they're becoming more and more frightened. And that is actually an appropriate response, in a way, to the conditions they're facing, because they feel and their institutions are rendering them helpless in the face of this. Mm-hmm. And there's no leadership to show them the way out. The leadership is or worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, once you raise the issue of Weimar, the Weimar Republic, you're talking about a failed state.
Yes.
You know, you're not far off if you take seriously the essay in Foreign Affairs magazine in, I think, the September-October edition by this woman named Sarah Chase. Named right. last name spelled Chayes,
right.
where she says, in effect, she compared the Afghan state, which we all know failed and collapsed, to the American state.
Right, it's its offspring. It looks like yeah. daddy.
Oh yeah, and she says they're both corrupt states, and the state has been hollowed out by corrupt elites who use the state to enrich themselves, and now the state has failed. It's a failing state.
Yeah.
And I think that does apply, whether you compare the U.S. state at this point to the Afghan state, or whether you compare it to the Weimar Republic, you see analogies, you see similarities. There are lessons from each that we can learn.
That's right.
I would just add one other thing that, you know, kind of looks like the Weimar Republic, and that is inflation and what could become in the United States hyperinflation.
Right. Let's print another $3 trillion and spend it on spend it on climate change initiatives.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
In other words, steal it.
In other words, steal it. And you think another $3.5 trillion unloaded in the U.S. economy of dollars printed by the Treasury, if you don't think that will kick off inflation along with the tie-up of the supply chains, you know, and stuff not being able to get from one place to the next, and all of that, we're looking at the possibility of hyperinflation, the United States going bankrupt, by which I mean it is will no longer be able to borrow money.
Right. Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And that's what is meant by the political crisis of whether or not the debt ceiling will be raised.
That's
that
right.
Means the United States won't be able to borrow, hence will not be able to pay past debts. I mean, look,
right.
Yeah, come on, Don. What are we looking at?
Well, look, first of all, we're talking $3.5 trillion. That's $1,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States, right?
Okay.
Being spent not on us, not on them, not on developing production capacity, not on roads, not on internet connections, not on any water supply, sewage supply, mortgage alleviation, eviction alleviation. It's not on any of that. It's going to be stolen, and it's going to be basically dumped into the economy where you have 2/3 of the people don't have $1,000. And so now whatever they do have is going to be diluted by that much, because that's how much we've expanded the money supply. And here's, I'm seeing that as the way Biden is looking at the people of this country. This is what he said about ASEAN yesterday. He said to them, I want you all to hear directly from me the importance the United States places on its relationship with ASEAN. That's what he said. And then he said, 15 cents a person. And then they say, what's the money going to be spent for? The new funding includes money for health spending, a new climate initiative, programs to assist with economic recovery from coronavirus, and education programs. You know, there's propaganda. Really, what they're going to do is they're going to spend it on climate initiatives and propaganda.
Yeah. Well, since Biden doesn't know whether he's coming or going most of the time,
right.
We have to assume that all of that is coming out of the office of the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken,
right.
Or the National Security Advisor, who I call, you know, Dr. Strangelove, I don't know who that guy is. Those Halloween movies where you wake up and a guy is standing over your bed with a dagger ready to
Jason,
stab.
Jason, yeah.
Yeah, serial killer kind of guy. But Jake Sullivan.
Yeah.
So these two guys are running foreign policy, no experience, but a lot of ideology and a lot of profiling, but they don't know the world that they live in. And,
right.
And you know, the other thing, this stupid shit with Taiwan,
right.
You know?
It's insane.
I mean,
it's insane.
We're dealing with complete incompetence, and somebody sometime is just going to have to say, these people are unable to govern this country. We need a new governing class, and the people are the best able to produce that new group of rulers of this country. In some circles, they would call it a democratic dictatorship of the people. And I think that's what we have to move towards. Otherwise, we're looking at a prolonged period of dark ages, chaos, and ungovernability.
And on that note, we'll say thank you very much and look forward to speaking with you again next week, Professor Montero.
Yeah, thank you so much, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.